John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we begin with a disturbing announcement from the brutal men responsible for kidnappings, mass slaughters, and the terrorizing of people in northern Nigeria.
We announce our allegiance to the Caliph of the Muslims and will hear and obey in times of difficulty and prosperity, in hardship and ease, and to endure being discriminated against, and not to challenge those who are in power except in the case of clear-cut infidelity.
Through an interpreter, the leader of Boko Haram, Abu Bakr Shekau, posted this video on Twitter to purportedly claim an alliance with the terrorists of ISIS in this self-proclaimed Islamic unity of purpose. Such a claim is easy to make in the era of Twitter and Facebook. So before we look at the rest of the news this hour, and it is not all about terrorists, thankfully, we are going to explore whether this consolidation by ISIS and other terror groups means a real alliance, or is it just an exercise in terrorist branding in our time? We want to put the question to Ryan Cummings, chief Africa analyst for Red 24, a crisis management company that's been following Boko Haram since 2011. Welcome, Ryan.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So can Boko Haram get help from ISIS in any tangible sense, or is this symbolic?
I think initially we have to look at more of the symbolic nature of the alliance. What Boko Haram has effectively done is claim that Islamic State and its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is the authority that Boko Haram will seemingly conform to. I think it's very early at this stage to suggest that the Pledge of Allegiance is going to translate into any form of operational and logistical exchange between the two organizations. It's definitely something that we cannot discount from happening in the near future.
Is it possible for ISIS to send insurgents and trainers into Nigeria in the way that the Cubans had operational advisors in Angola for many, many years?
I mean, it's definitely possible. I think that a lot of focus is on the direct linkage between Nigeria and the Levant, where obviously Islamic State is based and where they conduct most of their operations. But often what is overlooked is that Boko Haram is not the first African-based militant group to have pledged allegiance to Islamic State. We've got groups in Algeria, Egypt, and Libya who are currently operating under the Islamic State banner. And there is definitely concerns, and very credible ones at that, that these groups could forge some form of operational linkage between Boko Haram and possibly supply the group with both combatants and other forms of resources in terms of weaponry, financing, and other supplies.
Can you tick down the list of nations where there are insurgents that have declared some sort of allegiance with ISIS?
It's a little bit difficult to do so because in one of its issues of its magazine called Dabiq, Islamic State suggested that they received a pledge of allegiance from various countries, but they couldn't formally announce them because in certain of these countries, there were competing groups, some of which had obviously declared allegiance to Islamic State and others which were either operating independently or possibly even operating as an Al-Qaeda franchise. But we do know, as I mentioned, in North Africa, we've got pledges of allegiance to Islamic State from Libya, from Algeria, from Egypt. There's been pledges made from in Afghanistan, obviously some countries in the Levant, Syria and Iraq specifically, which forms the core of the movement. Also in Southern Asia, in Indonesia, possibly even the Philippines, I do believe that Islamic State may be working with groups and currently is in the process of forging some form of formal alliance, you know, with these various militant groups.
Is it conceivable that these groups have access to the same kind of funding that ISIS has in any sense?
I don't think so. Even after groups tend to pledge alliance to Islamic State, we're not seeing a discernible change in their modus operandi. It doesn't seem as if in the immediate term that there's been any exchange of resources or that they have access to, you know, Islamic State resources. I think it's more the perception that these smaller entities, they tend to almost be placed on an elevated pedestal after announcing their allegiance with a transnationalist network as massive as Islamic State, and just not in terms of numbers, but just in terms of their standing, you know, within the international jihadist community. And from a localized level, this adds credibility to these organizations and helps with their recruiting, possibly even helps them with forging some form of patronage, either from Islamic State directly or to some other donors who obviously sees ISIS as being quite a credible entity to provide some form of patronage to.
Well, it would seem that the upgrade is principally in recruiting, both among the local groups that raise their credibility, as you've said, by aligning themselves with ISIS, and also at the level of ISIS itself. Its credibility is bolstered, it would seem.
Most definitely. I think what's core to the discourse regarding ISIS, I mean, in both its video communiques and also just statements the group has made, it's always, you know, postured itself as expanding across various continents, and this current Islamic State that it's founded and forged within the Levant is inevitably going to spread across the world. You know, it's going to reach North Africa, it's going to reach Southern Asia, and when it's got a foothold in a country such as Nigeria, it does really reinforce that narrative that the group is going about achieving its ambitions of becoming this transnationalist network that is building this Islamic State that is, as I mentioned, you know, incorporating various continents and various regions.
The spin of ISIS as it acquires allegiances in Africa. Ryan Cummings is chief Africa analyst for Red 24, a crisis management company that's been following Boko Haram since 2011. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
We are forced to start work on...
How's your Russian? That's Vladimir Putin speaking unabashedly in a flashy Russian news program airing this week about the events more than a year ago when Russia moved to intervene in the Ukrainian Revolution. On the morning of the 23rd of February 2014, Putin, after a long all-night meeting, tells his interviewer, "We were obliged to start working on returning Crimea to Russia." This will come as a revelation to anyone not in Ukraine or Crimea, perhaps. But it is the first time Putin has admitted something that he formerly claimed was done only in response to pro-Russians in Ukraine who feared for their lives under a new Ukrainian regime. With this and other developments in Russia, we turn now to Gregory Pfeiffer, former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio and author of Russians, The People Behind the Power. Gregory, welcome.
Thanks, John.
How much of a shock will this be for Russians to see in this Russian news program, or will they pretty much jump up from their couches and rally to Vladimir Putin's sentiments here?
I think that's the Kremlin's goal. Now, there have been reports already in the Western media that a decision was taken in February during the Sochi Winter Olympic Games, and that Putin had convened a meeting of economists to ask them what would the costs that Russia would bear, what would they be for invading Ukraine. So this has been an open secret, and I think the goal here is to really generate support to show Putin to be the tough leader standing up to the West, taking Crimea back for Russia and presenting himself as sort of the chief nationalist politician in the country.
It seems to be a very friendly environment for Putin to do this. There was a piece in The Washington Post over the weekend describing that the anti-American sentiment in Russia right now is worse than it's ever been, even during the Cold War. What's your assessment of that?
I think that's right to an extent, because although the Soviet Union was a bigger enemy for the U.S. at the time, there was, of course, the Cold War. Now it's more grassroots. I mean, during the Cold War, a lot of Soviet citizens loved the United States. They wish they could visit it. And there were affinities and friendships between Americans who traveled to the Soviet Union and Russians at the time. Now Putin has been very successful at whipping up nationalism, anti-Americanism, xenophobia in general, in support of his presidency. And he's positioned himself as the leader of a coalition of countries that is standing up to the U.S. And as such, presenting himself as a tough guy. And this is very popular in Russia. It's a kind of a cycle. Putin has been whipping up these kinds of feelings for many years, but they're also genuine. He reads Russian society. He understands that Russians are nostalgic for the lost superpower status of the Cold War. He understands that they're envious of the West because, you know, Russians aren't stupid. They understand that they live in a corrupt authoritarian country where there are serious problems. This is an attempt to distract Russians from that, to show Putin to be acting in Russia's interests. But of course, he isn't. He's acting in Putin's interests. And for that reason, he's a very smart politician.
In this sympathetic environment and with this now open secret out in the absolute open about a meeting to deliberately annex Crimea, are Russians going to assume that soon there will be a meeting to do the same sort of thing in the Baltics, or is that a red line?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one of Putin's tactics is to keep people guessing, not only Russians at home, but his sort of would-be adversaries in the West. And certainly the Russians have been testing NATO's defenses, sending up Russian airplanes over or near the airspace of countries that are NATO members. I doubt that he would attack a NATO member country, but the idea is to keep testing, to keep showing Russia to be tough. And I think it's a very much of a sort of a KGB officer's mindset. Of course, Vladimir Putin's a former KGB officer, and I think he sees foreign policy as a game of opposition and subterfuge. Now, talking about Crimea, you know, this happened in the takeover of Crimea happened in a couple of weeks. These Russian elite troops infiltrated Crimea. They took over key government buildings and infrastructure. Now, this, of course, everybody knows this was planned in advance. And some people believe, I think, with a lot of reason, that the initial plans might have been laid as early as 2004 after the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. So I think the plans were always there. This was Putin lashing out and saying, well, if you Ukrainians get rid of your pro-Russia leader, we're just going to snatch Crimea. But of course, the plans were always there. And I think that Putin very much wants to sow doubt in the minds of Western countries, in the Baltic countries that are now essentially on the front line of a new Cold War with Russia. And he also wants to split European opinion, Western opinion. He views the European Union and also the transatlantic relationship between Europe and the U.S. as weak. And he thinks he's playing a strong hand, and I think we'll continue to see aggressive actions on his part.
Gregory Pfeiffer, former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio and author of Russians, The People Behind the Power. Gregory, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later this hour, just let him go. Let the animals escape from the zoo. Open the cages. From Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, zoos are critical to education, in my opinion, but much of their value lies in their management and outreach. Housing animals solely for that purpose is bad, but using them to educate us all about our impact on plants, animals, and the ecology is vital. We're going to hear a critique of the traditional argument for zoos later this hour, but there's no reason for you to wait to make a point.
Hi, my name is John from Wantagh, New York. And my daughter is in college studying conservation biology because she spent all the time as a kid at the Bronx Zoo, the New York Aquarium. So, yes, I believe in zoos.
This is Nicole from Seattle, and I just want to say I love animals so much. The part of me wants to love the zoo, but I have a very strong internal conflict because the animals probably don't love being in the zoo. And every time I go and see them, I think about that. As much as I love to see them, I don't know that they love to see me.
What do you mean? Those gorillas are all talking about how they're sending people to school to save them. Come on. Come on. They're overjoyed about being in the zoo. We'll talk about that a little later this hour. You can join the conversation, 8778-MY-TAKE. More of it later on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
What greater expression of faith in the American experiment than this? What greater form of patriotism is there than the belief that America is not yet finished? That we are strong enough to be self-critical? That each successive generation can look upon our imperfections and decide that it is in our power to remake this nation to more closely align with our highest ideals.
President Obama was among the thousands of Americans commemorating the 50th anniversary of the confrontation on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, that became the scene of America's Bloody Sunday. BBC North America correspondent Ali Makbul retraced the steps of those activists 50 years ago by walking from Selma to Montgomery, alongside some of the original marchers. Alim, welcome.
Yes, hello, John.
So what was this like? What did you see, and how much of the 50-year-ago events echoed today?
Well, we were looking back at history, but we were looking at the issues of the day as well. And we started out exactly where the marchers started out in 1965, a place called Brown Chapel, about a mile from the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And we, all along the route, we were chatting to people about their memories of the time, but also about the issues that remain today, that are unresolved today. But we started by speaking to one of those who was on the bridge that day, the youngest on the bridge that day, a lady called Cheyenne Webb Kreisberg.
Racism unleashed its brutality upon us. Tear gas had begun to burst in the air. People were being beaten down with billy clubs, as if they weren't even human beings.
What does Cheyenne do today?
Well, she has spent a lot of her time writing a book about her experiences. She is very much involved in trying to take things forward. And that's a bit about what we were looking at, because in that very area, there are some extraordinary, and actually, if I'm honest with you, quite depressing issues of the day. We spoke to the man who's in charge of schools, for example, there, the superintendent of schools in Selma, who says there is more segregation now than there was even 30 or 40 years ago. And that is because the situation down there is most of the white children of the area go to private schools, and almost all of the black children there go to public schools. And we spoke to one lady, an African-American lady called Tylisa Black, who tried to enroll her daughter into an, until then, all-white private school. And here's what happened.
How can we tell our five-year-old she can't go to school because of her color? So we filled the application out, we paid the fees, and we got a letter a few weeks later saying she had been accepted and that there was going to be a parents' meeting. So we're like, great. And a few weeks later, we go to this meeting, and there's like 500 people in this gym, and we're like, oh. And then a gentleman stood up and he yelled at the board and he said, you've ruined our heritage. You've allowed this to happen, and now you've ruined our heritage.
Sounds like there's a truce between the races down there that keeps these people separated, and to violate that is still pretty emotional.
It does sound like that, but there is a lot of tension bubbling under. And, of course, there are other issues aside from the segregation in schools issue, which for some people was the most serious one, because if you keep the races separate at that kind of age, it's much more difficult to get understanding later in life, of course. But there were, of course, issues that are being discussed down there about incarceration, about the criminal justice system. It's a debate that's happening across America, of course. And the rate of incarceration in Alabama is one of the highest in the country. And we heard people there, young black people there, saying they felt they were targeted. But on the other hand, we heard people in Selma say, you know, this is not, for example, Ferguson, because 80% of the police in Selma are black. So they feel there is progress being made. But there were other issues we were looking at as well. In the very week we were walking, of course, Alabama decided, its Supreme Court decided to ban gay marriage. So we were looking at whether or not that would be viewed in history in a similar way, whether Alabama's Chief Justice, for example, would be on the right side or the wrong side of history in that debate. And we looked at the very thing they marched for in 1965, which was voting rights. And there are many who feel the very Voting Rights Act that was passed following the Selma to Montgomery march is being eroded. But it was about the issues, these very serious issues, but it was also about the people we were meeting along the way. And I'm so glad that on the last night, with the family I was staying with, because I was staying with families along the way, I went with them to their Bible class. And there was an old gentleman at the back of the class who was very quiet, but at the end he came up to me. He said, you know, I was part of that march. And we talked a little bit, and he brought it back to what it was all about in the first place. It was a man called Napoleon Mays.
I do believe we shall overcome someday. And we were marching, you know, holding hands, you know, we were locked arm in arm across Highway 80. And those songs that kept us going, you know. We should never forget people lost their lives so you can be able to vote. And every vote do count.
a hopeful message, but a somber feeling of you retracing those steps. I'm getting the impression, Aleem.
Yes, I mean, I was, look, I'm talking personally, I was quite alarmed by some of the big issues that do remain. But you're right about that hopeful message. And that's why I say I was glad to have seen him at the end, because it does show, you know, in the face of huge adversity, when all does look lost, you know, things, big things, great things can obviously be achieved.
BBC North America correspondent Aleem Maqbool retracing the steps of the marchers 50 years ago who marched from Selma to Montgomery. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
More echoes now of We Shall Overcome from the commemorations of the 50th anniversary of the historic Selma, Alabama March. We leave you now with the words of President Obama speaking before a crowd of thousands in Selma.
For everywhere in this country, there are first steps to be taken. There's new ground to cover. There are more bridges to be crossed. And it is you, the young and fearless at heart, the most diverse and educated generation in our history, who the nation is waiting to follow. Because Selma shows us that America's not the project of any one person. Because the single most powerful word in our democracy is the word we. We the people. We shall overcome. Yes, we can. That word is owned by no one. It belongs to everyone.
Something tells me it's all happening at the zoo. I do believe it. I do believe it's true. The zoo.
Can you imagine Paul Simon at the zoo? In the ancient history of domesticating animals, zoos have a strange role to play, I think. Part entertainment, part educational setting. The motivation for collecting animals in zoos was a way of showing off the powerful hunting and explorer culture of the 1800s by bringing live creatures to cities to be caged and viewed in a carnival setting by people who bought tickets. Royal menageries go back much farther in history. In our time, zoos preach a preservationist message that seeing living examples of species threatened in the wild will encourage the 175 million annual zoo visitors to contribute to conservation measures. Well, in the latest issue of Outside Magazine, contributor Tim Zimmerman argues that the time has come to recognize that zoos are no longer needed, that they're bad for animals, and can delude people into thinking that zoo animals signify growing populations rather than species nearing extinction.
Zoos, or public urban zoos, were originally created in the 18th century as a place where people could see animals they otherwise would never see. These days, that's no longer the case. You can see and learn about animals in many, many different ways, all the way from YouTube videos to PBS nature specials. In addition, zoos are intended to educate and promote conservation. But most of the studies that the zoo industry has done on this topic really ask people whether they thought they learned something rather than whether they actually learned something. And finally, what we definitely know is that the animals, and many animals, suffer in zoos. There's high mortality rates, there are injuries, there's depression. Lots of zoo animals and lots of zoos employ antidepressants. And in particular, the science and research shows that wide-ranging animals, which are really the animals that are most popular for people to see, like tigers, bears, polar bears, are the animals that do worst in the zoos. So if you put all those together, increasingly it's difficult, I think, to justify zoos as a place to keep animals for our personal observation.
Is any zoo doing this appropriately in any way?
There are many zoos which have really taking great strides to improve the enclosures and conditions in which animals live. The Washington Zoo, which I've taken my own kids to, is a leader in the zoo industry. But the fact is that certain animals simply don't do well in zoos. And no matter how natural the tiger enclosure is, for example, it's still minuscule compared to what sort of range a tiger in the wild would have to roam. And so I think you just run up against the hard fact that if you want to teach people about tigers and get children excited about tigers, there's maybe a better way to do that than to keep tigers in zoos.
What would you do with the network of conservation-oriented individuals who are members of, say, the Bronx Zoo that have developed a global community of people who really do support conservation? If you ended the zoo overnight, where would that community go?
Well, you wouldn't end zoos overnight, but I do think that conservation is really the best argument for zoos these days. The only problem is that no matter what the zoo industry says about conservation, that's not really its primary mission right now. So less than 1% of the types of species kept in zoos are actually actively part of serious conservation. I think that much more could be done by targeting specific species that really do need conservation, and maybe evolving from urban zoos to sanctuary style or larger parks where the animals would really just have a much, much more room to roam and better lifestyles.
Does it concern you that videos of animals in the wild could easily outlive the extinction of any individual species and give humans the impression, oh, that's okay, we got them on video, and that it's only that animal alive that really makes the point that extinction is different from just capturing an animal in the wild?
I think that that is something to think about, but what's interesting is that there have been studies done on how people think about conservation and the future of species in the wild. And one of the things that sort of research shows is that, in fact, seeing animals in zoos cared for by humans and hearing about zoos' conservation plans and reintroduction plans and breeding plans sometimes tends to make people think that animals are doing better in the wild. So there is, on the one hand, something special, of course, of seeing an animal live, although I would argue it would be better to try to see it live in its natural habitat. But at the same time, zoos, for at least a certain number of people who visit them, sometimes have those people leaving thinking that, you know, things aren't as bad in the wild as they thought when they entered the zoo.
What do you make of the zoo alternative that you could see at, say, for instance, the American Museum of Natural History, the taxidermological diorama alternative?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, a point that people who support zoos make is that there's no substitute for seeing an animal alive and up close, and that's how you get especially younger generations interested and excited in the future of species and conservation of species. But what's true is that the model you mentioned has been spectacularly successful. I mean, there's an idea that somehow it's right for everyone to see the animals they want to see when they want to see them. I tend, after thinking about these issues for a long time, to feel like it's a privilege to see animals live and it's a privilege to see them in nature. And, you know, not everyone can spend the money it takes to go to Africa, but certainly everyone gets outside. And I believe that the encounters that you have with whatever wildlife is in the natural environment that you spend time in are the sorts of encounters that are really important and can get you interested in the natural world. And those are the sorts of encounters that people should look for rather than the more unnatural encounters in zoos in which the animals really aren't necessarily doing very well or even living very natural lives.
Tim Zimmerman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Tim Zimmerman is a contributor to Outside Magazine, and he doesn't have fun at the zoo, even when he takes his daughter. Are you on Tim's side on this one? Drew from La Grande, Oregon writes, I love zoos and being able to see all the animals I'd never otherwise be able to see, but I always leave feeling a bit melancholy about their captivity.
Hi, this is Mark Mannheimer. I'm calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. Having traveled extensively, I've seen some zoos that do a better job of housing their animals than others, but ultimately I feel it is more important and mindful of us to not cage or confine any animal.
The Bill of Little Rock, I think that zoos done correctly are a plus since there are several species that are preserved this way.
But preserved in a zoo, does that count as actually preserved? We'd love to know what you think. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to let us know if you would ever want to live in a zoo, the Chicago Zoo, the San Diego Zoo, the Bronx Zoo. They all look nice. Can't really pull the animals. Here's something to take with you at the end of the hour. There is a zoo you might go for at the University of Texas. Using 3D printing technology, scientists have created a tiny zoo with special enclosures just for harmful bacteria. The walls of the cages are 1% of the thickness of a hair. So it's really hard to get a lot of people. in this particular zoo. It's a microscopic zoo for watching how bacteria behave in different environments, observing what they do in their enclosures rather than simply counting their growth rate. You put a bacterium in a cage and just watch it. Quote, on a size scale that's relevant to what a single bacterium feels and senses. Think about that. What does a single bacterium feel and sense? You can listen back to anything you heard on this program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. And hopefully in this weather, you're not feeling like a zoo for bacteria. Get rid of those sniffles, won't you? I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.